You'll notice I've taken the cloth from the communion table because we'll share in communion in the Lord's Supper later on in the service. And I want to integrate that into what I share this morning. Once a month or whatever it might be, if you're Churches of Christ, every week, the Lord's Supper can become pretty ho-hum after a while. Repetition tends to flatten our enthusiasm. It's novelty that we seem to like, and the television tells us that all the time. When we were first in Ethiopia, we missed having ice cream. Well, there was one shop, a Swedish shop, a supermarket, where you could get it, and for some celebration after we'd been there some months, we went and paid about $10 for a little block about so big. There were four of us in our little family, and we got a sliver each, and it was marvellous. Now, we're out of ice cream again. Oh, well, we can manage. Flying for the first times like that, compared to when you've done it lots of times, like Daryl and Irene. Marriage can get like that. I mean, Mary and I have been married now for, heading up to 55, I think 56. Same, sleeping with the same person night after night. Pastors have the same problem when it comes Christmas, Easter, Mother's Day, Anzac Day. What do you say? That's right, isn't it, Barry? You have to think really hard. Communion can be like that. I want to do it a little differently today. Daryl's going to lead us around the Lord's table later on. But as Paul tells us, as often as you eat the bread and drink the cup, you proclaim, you preach the death of the Lord until he comes. There's a past dimension to the communion service. We're recognizing, celebrating, rejoicing in the fact that Jesus died for us. Redemption, forgiveness, atonement, knowing that we're forgiven before God. Wonderful. But I want to look at it today, the communion table, through the lens of the book of Revelation. The perspective I bring to the Revelation may be different from what you think. That's okay. But I think what I'm going to say has to undergird any interpretation you take of the book of Revelation. This, I think, is the big message as I understand it. And it might help us appreciate the Lord's table a little bit more this morning. The broad context of the last book of the Bible is letters written to seven churches by the Apostle John. He's a prisoner, a sort of, not under house arrest, under island arrest on Patmos. And he writes to these churches in modern-day Turkey. It's in the context of a hostile Roman empire, where at different times emperor worship was the thing. Christianity was seen as a threat to the Roman Empire because it had another king. And it was a threat to Judaism, and so you get the opposition from Jews. Now, Revelation is structured by a series of scenes. So John says, I saw. After that, I saw. And then I saw. If you look through Revelation, you'll find there are many of those. Each one introduces some new picture. John is invited by up to heaven to have a look so that he can learn what's going to happen in the future. And we get the sort of the thrust of Revelation straight away in chapter 4. It's not about plagues and death and disease and wars. Chapter 4, chapter 5, a worship. That's what it's about. God's people with God praising him. That gives us a clue. Well, I'll skip chapter 4. Oh, I'm not going to go through every chapter. There are 22. I'm not going to go through every verse. There are a couple of hundred of them, I think. So I'll skip chapter 4 chapter 5 comes up with a big problem. A big problem. There's a scroll and it's sealed, it's locked. Who is worthy to open it? It's going to be the unveiling of the sort of the course of history and of God's victory in it. And then you find the strong angel. He says, who's worthy to break the seals on this scroll and open it? No one in heaven, earth, under the earth, was able to open it and read it. And John says, I began to weep. So he's caught up in this drama. Stop weeping. Look, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the heir of David's throne, has won the victory. He is worthy to open the scroll and its seven seals. And then I saw a lamb looking as though it had been slaughtered. An immediate picture of Jesus, of course. We know that. He is worthy to open the scroll. And the 24 elders, they fall down and worship before the Lamb. You're worthy to take the scroll and break its seals and open it. You were slain, and your blood has ransomed, has rescued for God a people from every tribe and language and people and nation. And they sang a mighty chorus, worthy is the Lamb who was slain. Does that give us a kind of a sense of what this book's about? I should just explain one other thing before I kind of get into it. I spent about 6 years of my life reading this kind of literature. This Revelation is just one book amongst dozens of Jewish books that have pictures of all kinds and funny animals and heads and all that sort of thing. It's a special kind of literature. And you have to read that any kind of literature according to the recipe for reading it, if you know what I mean. It's no good trying to eat a bowl of soup with a fork. It doesn't work, and you get into problems. We need to understand this literature in its own terms, the way the writers and the readers back in John's day did understand it. So we've got these symbols in this kind of literature. People from every tribe and language and people and nation. Come back to that in a minute. I remember not long after we first arrived in Ethiopia, and that's back in not only in the last century but a long time ago, but things make an impression on you, don't they? Certain things. And I remember the first communion service that we were present at in Ethiopia, and it was a surprise because we were foreigners. We thought they were all Ethiopians. No, they weren't. There were 13 different nationalities there. Well, ethnic groups, all one in Christ Jesus. Now, I'm looking around this morning, and what can I see? Koreans, Philip. Stand up, the Koreans. Come on, all Koreans up. You won't be alone. Others will come. Because the Thais are next. Up they get. Quick. Stand up. Who else have we got? Germans. Kathleen. The Dutch. Irene, you count as a Dutch. You're half Dutch. Stand up half. You're Dutch, Jean. Yeah. There you go. Oh, yes. And they're definitely not Europeans, are they? Stand up the British. Any British? Who's that, Kathleen? Oh, yes. Yeah, I see John and Josie there, yes. Sudanese. Hey, come on, kids, stand up with Mum. Yeah. Spanish, yes. Connie, Valentin, help me. They're Aussies. No. New Zealand, oh dear. Look, we're going to miss out some, so, and all the Aussies. Now, the rest of you can sit down. Yeah. Do you know what? It doesn't matter what nationality you are, what ethnicity you are, redeemed by the blood of the Lamb. People from every tribe and nation and language, upon a life I didn't live, upon a death I didn't die, on another's life, on another's death, I stake my whole eternity. That's you. See, Revelation's quite short, isn't it? Down on the left side, I've put in yellow, not exactly right, the good bits, and on the right, the bad bits. And you can see something happening here in the way the book is set up. We start off with worship, because in the end, that's what it's about. Then we get the horrible things, not all of them. We get a break. There's another worship bit. Then some more horrible things. And then another worship bit. Things in the end are not bad, because they're God's. More troubles, and then eventually the new heavens and the new earth. It's easy to miss the point of this book, because if you get caught up with trying to identify things happening today with bits and pieces, symbols and whatever in the Revelation, you may miss the big picture. You can still understand the book within another framework. That may be okay, but this is the big point, I think. This is about encouraging God's people in a hostile world. There's war, there's death, there's plague, there's famine, there's hardship, there's persecution, there's suffering, but there's a Lamb who redeems. Apocalypse, that'd be Hollywood's picture of apocalypse, wouldn't it? Hey, foundation for movies. Whee! Rubbish. Do you know what apocalypse means? The apo bit means from, and the calypse bit means cover. The cover is taken from what lies ahead. You know, eucalyptus, the gum tree, eu means well. So the flowers are well covered. They have a little cap on them and a operculum. So apocalypse is not about explosions and disasters and Hollywood. This is the unveiling, the taking the cover off what's ahead by Jesus Christ. It's the revelation, the apocalypse of Jesus Christ that he makes. There are contrasts in the book between plague and disaster and so on. But there's safety, there's salvation, there's redemption, and there's life. You get the horses. So a whole lot of different pictures. Each of these different sections is started by, after this I saw, or then I saw another little scene. So here these four horses, and that pale one on the right is death. And for some of us, that's probably closer than it is for others. Seriously, just last night I had an email from a good friend down in Victoria, been a Bible college lecturer and missionary, found out on Thursday, he said, that I've got pancreatic cancer. I'll find out this week how they're going to try to treat it, but of course it's untreatable in the end. Encouragement from looking through the windows of it. Let me read a little bit out of Revelation chapter 7. It's the second of those worship sections. By the way, redeemed by the blood of the Lamb, looking as though we've been slain, dead. Wait on. They're worshipping him. He must be alive. Past, his death. Present, he's alive. I am the living one. I was dead, and now look, I'm alive forever and ever. And I hold the keys of death and Hades. Hades meaning where the dead go, death meaning the gateway to it. Hades was just the Jewish name. They didn't know where the dead went, really. So they had a name for it, Hades or Sheol. In chapter 7, after the first six bits of the seven seals, you get the seventh one. And that sort of opens up to the next scene. Seven trumpets, all bad. Age-long conflict, two beasts. But Revelation 7 starts off talking about 144,000. The Jehovah's Witnesses say the places are pretty well all taken, I think, don't they? Not to worry. Don't worry. You don't need to become a Jehovah's Witness in order to grasp one of those last spots, because it's wrong. They're not Jehovah's Witnesses. That is a picture of the complete people of God. It's actually equal to the great multitude that comes immediately after it, just looked at from different angles, different scenes or pictures. How do you get 144,000? It's a symbolic number, not an actual number. To be like, we're not. God doesn't go around and say, number 1, 2, 3, 4, 143,999, and Jenny Leslie's the last. No. Look at it. To multiply a number by itself, to square it, makes it perfect in Jewish ideas about numbers. And there are 12 tribes. That makes 144. And then 10 by 10 by 10 to cube the number, that makes it perfect too. Put them together and you get 144,000. Are they the literal tribes of Israel? No. I'll tell you how I know, because it's not the right list. One of the tribes is missing. Dan is missing because of its history. In other words, it's sort of reminding us of failure. So the 12 tribes are kind of synthetic, if you like. After this, I looked, and there was before me a great multitude that no one could count, from every tribe and nation and people and language, standing before the throne and the Lamb. The 144,000 are all sealed. I guess that means that they've got God's protective mark on them. So they'll be all right in the end. They're the ones who are suffering. They're the ones who are persecuted. They are include us who believe in Jesus. God's looking after us. In the end, God will care for us. We have personal ordeals, don't we? In John's day, they were facing imprisonment, gladiators, death, and so on. Some of us have experienced some of that from family when we converted to Jesus. Others, well, I remember being at a funeral of a doctor who was murdered by people for whom he was setting up a mobile medical clinic out in the desert. And those he'd come to help medically and to share Jesus with killed him. These are the ones who've come out of the great tribulation. They've washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Now, this great multitude is a great missionary challenge, isn't it? It helped send me overseas and into Christian ministry. That sort of concept, to translate the Bible to win people to Christ, to be this great multitude. So despair and hopelessness, it's going to go. And we come down through the plagues, the bowls, the fall of Babylon. Babylon standing for world empires that are anti-God. Goodness me. Think about how our civilization these days is moving progressively further and further away from the truth of God. Not just in ideas, but in morals, in lack of integrity and so on. Then we've got the 144,000 again. I think technology's playing havoc, actually. Never mind, we'll get there. A rider on a horse. His clothes have been dipped in blood. See, we're not talking about actual we're talking about symbol, picture. A sword is coming out of his mouth, standing for the word of God, the truth of God. It's not long after this, the final judgment follows and Satan is heaved down into the bottomless pit. Hell's no joke, as one little girl understood, because in her class, the teacher was explaining that the whale couldn't possibly swallow anyone because its gullet was too small. And the little girl said, well, Jonah got swallowed by a whale. She wasn't quite right there, but that's what she said. He got swallowed by a whale. Oh, no, that's not possible. And so the kid says to the teacher, take note, Denise, you might get this. Oh, well, when I get to heaven, I'll ask him. Ah, but what if Jonah went to hell? Oh, well, you ask him then. She actually knew it was serious. But people who use hell as a swear word have lost it. Hell's no laughing matter. We've missed out the marriage supper of the Lamb. I don't know where it went. It's in there. It will happen, but not in our talk. Yeah, the wedding of the Lamb has come in chapter 19. His bride has made herself ready. Blessed are those who are invited. Who's invited? You who love Jesus and trust him. The future, a past, a lamb slain. I am the one who lives forever and ever, the living Lord. And then the future. The Lord's Supper points us to the future. Beyond the grave, no tears, no death, no crying, no pain. I saw a new heaven and a new earth, John says. Look, God's dwelling place is among people and he'll dwell with them. And they'll be his people and God himself will be with them and be their God. And he'll wipe away every tear from their eyes. No more death or mourning or crying or pain. The old order of things has passed away. I'm making everything new. Hope for the future sustains in the present. That's a picture of a Deutsche, Kathleen, German, Jürgen Moltmann, a theologian. He was a prisoner of war between 1945 and 1948, so he was in the German army. He says, in July 1943, I was an Air Force auxiliary in a battery in the centre of Hamburg and barely survived the firestorm which the Royal Air Force's Operation Gomorrah let loose on the city. The friend standing next to me was torn to pieces by the bomb that left me unscathed. That night, I cried out to God for the first time, my God, where are you? And the question, why am I not dead too, has haunted me ever since. Why are you alive? What gives your life meaning? He says he came from a secular family, no Christian foundations at all. His sister, meaning well, when he joined up in the Air Force, she gave him a little book, a special edition for the forces of Goethe's poems. Well, wonderful poetry, but not with any Christian foundation. She gave them to him for comfort. The end of the war and the summer of 1945 brought cold horror into the camp where he was a prisoner still. The thought of being no way out was like an iron band constricting our hearts, a stranglehold that choked us, and each of us tried to conceal his stricken heart behind an armour of untouchability. In the Scottish labour camp, because he got transferred, together with some other astonished prisoners, I was for the first time given a Bible by a well-meaning army chaplain. Some of us would have rather had a few cigarettes. I read it without much comprehension until I stumbled on the Psalms of Lament. You know, the ones that say, oh, my God, why have you forsaken me? Then I came to the story of the Passion and I read Jesus' death cry, my God, why have you forsaken me? I knew then with certainty that this was someone who understood me. I began to understand the crucified Christ because I felt he understood me. This was the divine brother in distress who takes prisoners with him on the way to resurrection. So here is an encounter with the crucified Jesus, forsaken by his Father in that dark night on the cross. Here's resurrection. He is a living Lord with hope for the future, now and forever. The communion service is about past, present and future. We rejoice in the past because it means the Lord is with us in the present and he's taking us with him to share that security of heavenly presence with him in the future.